This is WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro.
Okay, this is the Wilp Radio Show. We're here every Wednesday from 5 to 6. Wilp is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And we're very happy today to have one of our Wilp members, Lucy Lewis, is with us. And Lucy, we're going to talk about Wilp, but also start off talking about the big march and rally about voting rights in Winston-Salem on Monday. So welcome to the Wilp Radio Show, which you've been a part of for a long time.
Thank you. It's good to be here today.
Okay. Is our sound okay? We're just getting started. Okay, good. Okay. So Lucy, you were at the rally. I was at the rally. Emily, Iris, all of us in the room here. Emily O'Hare is doing our board, and Iris is working with us. And I'm Lori Hoyt, and we're getting ourselves organized and getting started. Okay, I think we're ready. Okay, so Lucy. We were all there. This was a real important occasion. There was a reason we were all there. It was the first day of the court case. Do you want to tell us more about it?
Sure. And also, I'd just like to add that not only am I a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and a member of our steering committee, but also a member of the Chapel Hill Carrboro branch of the NAACP and an at-large member of the executive committee. So actually, I'm here today in both of those capacities because both groups did major work mobilizing for the voting rights march and rally that was held on Monday. And as many of our listeners know, this was the culmination of months of work in the courts to try to address the very regressive what we call the monster voter intimidation and suppression law that was passed by the North Carolina General Assembly 2 years ago in 2013. And, of course, the background of that was the action by the Supreme Court in their case of Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder. And the result of that action by the Supreme Court was basically to gut the Voting Rights Act. One of the key provisions had been to require 11 states and then a number of states with counties to get what's called preclearance, which means that they would have to get federal approval before they could make changes to their voting laws. And once that happened, immediately in North Carolina, the General Assembly said, we're going to bring on the full bill, which meant that they had had a draft in their back pocket, which would basically do away with a lot of the changes that have been made since 2000 to increase access to the ballot and increase access to the voting booth, and had meant that we'd seen significant changes happen. So with the passage of that bill, which I'm sure we'll talk more about, the North Carolina NAACP, the Advancement Project, which is a civil rights organization, the League of Women Voters.
And I don't think a lot of people realize the League of Women Voters and what the Justice Department
and the U.S. Department of Justice are plaintiffs in this case. As well as a number of individuals who feel that their voting rights have been abridged. So Monday was the beginning of the court case, and thousands of people hit the streets basically to say that we in North Carolina believe that North Carolina is our Selma, was our rallying cry, and that everybody deserves a right to vote.
Yeah, and to get back to the Supreme Court, it's really ironic, especially in light of some subsequent events, because that was, a couple of years ago? And I think that their feeling was that I'm not sure if they use this terminology, that we're post-racial, we have a black president, that it was no longer needed to monitor these 11 states, most of which were Southern, if not all of them, on how they do voting accessibility. And since then, I think race difficulties and tensions and injustices have been at the forefront with Ferguson and Charleston and New York and many other places, Baltimore, and it just shows, you know, how hasty they were or how wrongheaded they were, and it has opened the floodgates not only for North Carolina but for several other states to start enacting these laws that suppress voting rather than encourage voting. And maybe you could tell our listeners what, just in the couple of years before they started this monster kind of regression, what were some of the laws that have been put in place to encourage more democracy and more voting?
Well, actually, I'll go a little bit further than that.
Okay.
My understanding is that the argument that the Supreme Court made was that the formula that was used in 1965 to determine which states and which states with counties had to get preclearance was based on a formula, one showing that there had been intense discrimination in terms of voting rights and also low voter turnout.
Okay.
So after we saw greater voter turnout in North Carolina and other states, particularly spurred on by the election of Barack Obama, they said, well, that formula no longer holds. Well, a lot of people had argued that perhaps that formula didn't hold, but that still there had been attempts over the years to redress the fact that we had had historically low African-American voter registration and turnout. So one of the things that happened here in North Carolina as a result of progressive groups working together, people that believe in the importance of the vote, were changes in the law. So what we saw in 2000 was that early voting was allowed in North Carolina for the first time. In 2005, for the first time, they said you could vote outside your precinct if it wasn't an election that was specific to precincts. And then in 2007, we saw same-day registration. And in the last two elections, for example, we saw major increases in African-American turnout, and significant numbers of folks were using both of those advantages or those new opportunities. The more than 90,000 North Carolinians in 2012 did same-day voter registration.
Wow.
And then 900,000 voters last year or in 2012 took advantage of...
What was that? What number was that again?
900,000
wow.
Voted in early voting and 90,000 voted in same-day voter registration. So the kind of laws you're talking about took decades to get passed here in North Carolina, but once they got passed, it had a major impact on our elections. Of course, what happened after the 2013 decision by the Supreme Court was that a number of states, including North Carolina, immediately move to make changes that it's going to make it much harder to redress these decades of progress to try to make voting more accessible, particularly to African-American voters, voters of color, and low-income voters.
Yeah. So there was no embarrassment on their part. As soon as the Supreme Court's decision, they jumped right in and started, you know, doing laws that make it more difficult to vote, which really means suppressing voting. And we're supposed to be a democracy, and we have one of the worst voting records of a lot of countries in terms of the amount of people who participate. So it would seem like if you really care about democracy, you would be trying to increase participation, and they immediately set about to make it more difficult.
That's right.
Yeah, which is heartbreaking. So rather than just taking it sitting down, people are trying to fight back or do something to stop that. And that court suit is one of many things that people are trying to do.
I think the mood on Sunday in the ecumenical service that was held the night before with over 1,200 people in Winston-Salem.
Was there that church service?
It was a really big turnout. And then with 6,000 some folks on the streets in Winston-Salem was one of recognizing how hard fought the first Voting Rights Act had been. That Sunday, Bloody Sunday, in the spring of 1965, had really awakened the national consciousness, particularly of white America, to realize that African American voters for decades had been fighting for voter registration and voter access, and finally paid in blood with those who were hurt, like John Lewis, and those who were murdered for voter rights, finally got the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And here we were 50 years, almost to the month. It'll be August 6, 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, that we're back again. So I think that people there were reflecting back on that. Some people were saying, you know, I never believed that I would be here in 2015 fighting for voting rights and voting access.
I heard many people say that on Monday, you know, that I can't believe that here it is all these years later and we still have to fight that fight again. It's you know, sort of you're incredulous, but you know what's happening, and it's so heartbreaking and enraging that that we have to keep fighting these battles over and over again. And thank goodness that people are willing to still get up and fight the battles and do something about it, but it's so disheartening.
I think another thing that folks were thinking about, and that Reverend Barber, the president of the North Carolina NAACP, has been very clear about, is this is historic, this trial that's taking place in Winston-Salem, that it's really the first state test of changes in election laws since the Supreme Court decision.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens here will affect the South as mm-hmm. well as other states.
Mm-hmm.
That after the Congress gutted, or the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, 21 states have created new voter restriction laws.
Mm-hmm.
And in 21 states.
Wow.
In the last 5 years, that's happened, and majority of those have been after 2013. And 2016 will be the first presidential election since those restrictions have been in place. And so whether we can fight this both in the courts as well as in the streets, and to affirm the basic principle that mm-hmm. The Constitution and the Voting Rights Act both affirmed the right of that there shouldn't be laws passed that would restrict access to the
mm-hmm.
ballot. So here we are. In North Carolina.
In North Carolina.
Taking on this fight. And like you said, we've got a lot of strong allies, the League of Women Voters, the Advancement Project, the Department of Justice are all saying that this law is going to have a disparate impact. It's going to disproportionately impact our voters, our African-American voters, our voters of color, and our low-income voters who have all kinds of obstacles and who've been able to vote in greater numbers with laws that really encourage it. And we know that there are states, for example, I think it's Washington State, where you can mail in your ballot. You know, that people in certain parts of the country are working to make it easier to vote. In addition to some of the things we mentioned earlier, in North Carolina, we also had a law passed that made it possible to pre-register as 16 and 17-year-olds. And that seems like a, you know, a common sense kind of action to take. We want young people to be involved in voting. We want young people to have a say in what happens.
And to be encouraged.
Exactly. So we've seen a lot of progress here in the state. We've seen it snatched away, and people are standing up all over the state, and it's attracting national attention. We saw that the New York Times editorial board today came out with a really strong statement about this, that they recognize that this
oh,
is
really?
Really history in the making.
Oh, that's hopeful. Yeah, that you know, if they get that kind of publicity all over the country, that really is so helpful.
Yeah, I could actually share some of that if
yeah,
if our readers
you?
Haven't
yeah.
all seen it online or in the gotten a copy of it. It's called North Carolina's Voting Law Goes on Trial, and it was by the editorial board, like I said, of the New York Times today. And they start out by saying, it would have been bad enough if the North Carolina legislature, in a misguided effort to streamline voting procedures, had passed a law that ended up having discriminatory effects. But what happened was far worse than that. The state's Republican lawmakers, in passing House Bill 589 in 2013, actually repealed a series of smart and successful voting rights measures that were enacted over the last 15 years to expand North Carolina's access to the most fundamental of all American rights. And it goes on to say, the state's lawyers argue that North Carolina is behaving no worse than other states, New York included, that have no early voting, same-day registration, or out-of-precinct voting. Those lapses are a discredit to those states, but they're not an excuse for North Carolina to turn back its own clock.
Well, and that's pretty bad. Oh, we're not the worst, so it's okay what we're doing. You know, it's not a very, very good or an argument that has integrity to it. It's, you know, it's sort of, oh, well, not the worst, so I guess it's okay.
And I think a lot of other articles written in the last couple of weeks looking at this trial have pointed out that the North Carolina state lawyers, the state arguing for this law, have really ignored the history in North Carolina and other states.
Mm-hmm.
That this is not a neutral act that's taking place, and that in fact the Voting Rights Act was enacted precisely because there had been so many barriers. And even though we're not talking about literacy tests or poll taxes, we're talking about much more subtle discrimination now.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not any less real.
And Lucy, what I've heard, and I think that's right, that different states are enacting different barriers, but that North Carolina is the worst because they have all of them, that all the different barriers that one state may be cutting back on this and another state that, but that North Carolina's is the most draconian and the worst because they've taken all of them, and at one time they're putting in place so many aspects of these different restriction laws, so that we have the worst of the worst.
We actually do. It's the most extreme.
Now,
one of the provisions that is not going to be part of this particular court case is the voter ID bill, and I think probably a lot of people have heard about that, that was the original bill that was going to be proposed in the North Carolina General Assembly. They were using the fraudulent argument that we had serious problems with voter ID, of people voting twice or voting in different states. And they came up with some huge numbers. And then as people drilled down into those numbers, it turned out that those aren't real at all, that there have only been two cases in North Carolina in the last decade of voter ID fraud. But that provision, which was probably the most blatantly discriminatory, actually has been softened by the General Assembly in the last couple of weeks.
Just in time for the trial.
That's right, because it was really the clearest example of trying to roll back those changes that have been made. So what the General Assembly said several weeks ago was that a voter could say that they were not able to vote in their own precinct or during the early voting period, and then they would sign a form and attest to that. Now, we know that in some of our more rural communities, in some of our majority black precincts, giving people that right on paper is not the same thing as making it a reality. But again, that particular clause has been taken out of this bill, and it'll be debated at a later date, giving the attorneys for both sides more time to think about what the implications are of that. But the remaining changes that are in effect with pre-registration of teens and shortening, they shorten the number of early voting days, not hours, but if that still means that there have is a shorter period in which people can register and vote, same-day voter registration. All of those changes were wrapped up together into this most extreme bill.
Yeah, and some people, they mostly did hear about the voter ID law, so when they soften that, they may think, oh, you know, the problem's being taken care of. That was very smart, underhanded tactic by the legislature, but thank goodness, I think as people get more information, they'll see there was a whole lot more to this voter suppression than that one thing. So, and I just feel heartened at the support that the state NAACP is getting from these other organizations, particularly, you know, the League of Women Voters has such a good reputation in this country for trying to have fairness in voting. Of course, the Justice Department has a lot of clout. So, you know, all of that together, I hope, is going to make a powerful enough united force that we have a really good chance of beating this.
Well, if you look at the facts of the case on the street, yes. In the courts, it's harder because you have to prove that it has a disparate impact, and sometimes that's hard to do.
Okay.
The article in The Independent today talks a little bit about that.
Okay.
Where the General Assembly and the state lawyers basically are saying, we saw increased turnout in 2014. Therefore, these laws didn't have a dampening effect. And, of course, Reverend Barber correctly points out that that was a very hotly contested election.
Yes.
When we had an important state Senate seat that was
Kagan.
Up. One of the architects of the bill was up for election, and the 12th Congressional District, which is one of the districts that was created to ensure black representation, had an open contest for the first time in decades. So whether they can parse the law finely enough to say that it could stand is not clear.
Mm-hmm.
But we certainly think that if you look at the issues behind it, why we had a Voting Rights Act in the first place, how that was fought for, and people died for that. And it's taken us 50 years to get to the point where we've got the changes that we made in North Carolina, and made North Carolina actually look progressive in relationship to the other southern states, where we saw that we could really be proud of our state for trying to increase ballot access. Is now under attack.
I know when those we started getting early voting and other things, you know, it was like, okay, it's taken a long time, but you know, we're making progress. It was just such a good feeling, you know. Oh, what other good thing is next? I mean, you just kept thinking, you know, little by little by little, things get better, or you hope that, and then to have them just totally come to a screeching halt and start pedaling backwards as fast as they can, you know, it was just such a shock, you know. And I guess I would have thought that they would be embarrassed that right on the heels of the Supreme Court decision is sort of making the Supreme Court look like fools. You know, the Supreme Court saying, oh, things are so improved and, you know, we don't need it anymore. And no sooner gets out of their mouth than they're proving them totally wrong. So if I was the Supreme Court, which I'm sure they don't think of things that way, I would just be so embarrassed and pissed off at these states. That would be a normal reaction. You know, if I was operating in good faith, I thought I really believed all that, and that's what I voted for. And then, lo and behold, they're showing that it was totally wrong.
I think the Supreme Court justices who voted to get the Voting Rights Act knew what they were doing. I don't think that they were very surprised. I think that they had looked at the increase in turnout, particularly among black voters, in 2008 and 2012, and had thought, what can we do to make sure this doesn't happen again?
So they didn't vote in good faith, in other words, you know?
I think you can look at the figures. In North Carolina, in 2000, we were 37th nationally in voter turnout. And that was the same year when we began making some of these changes. In 2004, we were 38th in voter turnout. But by 2008, we were 22nd. And by 2012, we were down to 11th.
Oh, wow. Those
we went
are
from
powerful
37th
things.
To 11th in that period of time. And 2000 was when they had begun to make these changes. And I think the Supreme Court, looking nationally at what happened, which was that states were increasingly taking steps, like North Carolina, to try to make more access to the voting booth.
We got to stop that, huh?
And then, like you said, we had the election of our first black president.
Yes.
And they were able to use that facade of being in a post-racial period. And I think as we're all too aware, in just the last year alone, all the horrific incidents that have occurred with police-related deaths, and most recently the murders in Charleston of 9 martyrs, show how clearly not only are we not living in a post-racial society, but that the election of a black president has unleashed a backlash.
It has.
And that we haven't seen the end of that yet.
We're talking to Lucy Lewis. One of the feedback I got was that our guests are interesting, but that we only announce it at the beginning. I've been told to remind myself to mention who our guest is throughout a little bit more often. So we are talking to Lucy Lewis, who is a WILF member and NAACP member and on the executive board of our local branch of the NAACP. And we're here talking about voting rights and the first day on Monday of a historic court case in the federal courthouse in Winston-Salem of the state, North Carolina NAACP, the Justice Department, the League of Women Voters, the Advance Project. Advancement Project, suing Governor McCrory for the a bunch of it's not just one voter suppression laws that have been just enacted recently in the wake of a Supreme Court decision gutting the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So here we are. Yeah, boy, what the dovetailing of 65 to 15. Here we are, having to go to court again, and to fight for the right to vote for everybody. And that's a sad commentary. We're moving close to our
break.
Our break. And I'm Lori Hoyt, and Emily O'Hare is going to read who we are.
This is WILF Wake Up Call, 103.5 FM. Our special guest today, and I'm going to reiterate, is Lucy Lewis, talking about voting rights and the march in Winston-Salem, and she's giving us such good background on what happened and how things happened. We are underwritten by Internationalist Bookstore, which is located practically across the street from the Arts Center on Lloyd Street. I just have one announcement that I wanted to make, and this is, and I don't know if anybody else saw it, but it is it was an email this morning from Common Cause, and it was Senator Patrick Leahy, and he introduced a bill called the Voting Rights Advancement Act, and which would restore the Voting Rights Act. And that, as Lucy already mentioned, that the Supreme Court gutted in 2013, which led to the problems that we're having now in North Carolina. But I was just thinking, to say that we should call our senators and our representatives to vote yes on this. And it's Senate Bill 1659 and House of Representatives 2867. And again, it's the Voting Rights Advancement Act. And it would restore the Voting Rights Act.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah. Okay. And is that all the – yes, sir, we've been announcing Monday the 13th for so long. Every week we've been pushing that. So now we can talk about the Voting Rights Advancement Act, and I'm sure there'll be other things coming along. We'll be wanting to pay attention to what happens in court. The NNO has had some pretty not great, but okay coverage, and told some of what transpired the first day in yesterday's paper. Lucy, you just mentioned that on page 10 of the Independent, now called the Indy, which is a free political and cultural paper that's free around town, then on page 10 they have an article about it. Mm-hmm. So I think anybody who's listening, find out as much as you can about it. Tell people, because a lot of people get caught up in their own lives and struggles, and sometimes there's just so much going on they don't get all the details. So this is really important for everybody to kind of know what's involved, how crucially important it is, because if we can't vote in the good guys, then the bad guys are going to be there, and we've got to at least have a fighting chance to try to get the good guys in.
Well, I think in terms of what you're saying of making sure that all of us are educated about these issues, mm-hmm. It's easy with the lack of good media sometimes, mm-hmm. and false propaganda to think that, in fact, these issues have already been settled.
I know
that a lot of people, young people in particular, saw the movie Selma this spring. And, of course, that showed the historic marches across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and the fight for voting rights and then the passage of Voting Rights Act. So you left that movie thinking, wow, this is great. We've won. And I was just going to read a quick quote from The Nation, which had an article this week about the trial. They said, in 3 weeks, the country will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, the most important civil rights law of the 20th century. Many will note the tremendous accomplishment of the act and how much progress the nation has made as a result. But this is not a time for celebration. Voting rights are at risk across the country, nowhere more than in North Carolina. The Confederate flag has finally come down in South Carolina, but North Carolina is still fighting the last battle of the Civil War.
Wow.
And I think that was one of the things that those of us in the crowd heard on Monday afternoon and evening, was after the murders in South Carolina, finally the Confederate flag came down in South Carolina. And that was a very important symbolic act, that battle flag should never have flown over the Capitol. And as many people know, it only went up in 1961 in response to the civil rights demonstrations. It was important that it came down. And in fact, it was brought down by Bree Newsom, who's a North Carolina activist, a week prior to that. I think charges are still pending against Ms. Newsom and the colleague that helped her with that.
That was an exciting video.
Indeed. That was a very brave act.
Very brave
to make
act.
It very clear. But as we talked about Monday, as important as that symbol was, unless it's followed up by real change, then those lives will have been lost, and we will have lost a symbol, but we wouldn't have seen real change. And in 65, what happened was, after lives were lost, we saw the passage of the bill. Yeah. And there, the kind of bill that Emily was referencing, are the kinds of changes we need to see happening now.
Yeah.
That if anyone was not paying attention before, they should be paying attention now, mm-hmm. to what this backlash looks like in our country. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Barber and the other speakers Monday night, I think, were so eloquent in both celebrating that symbolic action but calling for real change and saying that this trial and the overturning of this voter intimidation and suppression law would be an important way to remember those people who lost their lives.
Yes, that would be wonderful. So if this court case, so we all really need to be paying attention, who's covering it? I guess the newspaper, the NNO's covering it. Is there any of the local TV stations, I wonder, that's covering it? I don't look very much at local TV, so if we hear of any station that is given good coverage, we'll let you all know next week. But
or if people are social media users, the Winston-Salem Journal has actually done a couple of really excellent articles and videos.
Okay.
And since the trial is taking place there in Winston-Salem, they're obviously paying attention to it.
Yeah.
But, of course, just some of the articles we've mentioned today, the New York Times, the Independent, the Nation, the Guardian, the Atlantic, have all had articles on this. People around the country are watching what's happening here.
Also, the NAACP probably has lots of information, articles, and you could view some of the speeches online.
You can. You can go to Facebook. The NCNAACP is what you need to type in, or you can go to ncnaacp.org is the website with lots of information, and they will be posting updates.
That's a great idea. Great idea. So pay attention, follow this, because if this trial goes well, if we win, then this is going to affect voting all over the country.
And we know that no matter what happens, the case will go to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
That if the NAACP wins the case, that the state plans to appeal, and if the state wins the trial, we definitely know that NAACP and the other plaintiffs will go forward.
To the Supreme Court.
But another important note, I think, just to contrast this, which is talking about the draconian measures that the North Carolina General Assembly has taken, is to put it within the context of the people's struggle. Not only did they march in Selma, but we've been marching here in North Carolina since 2008 was the first historic Thousands on Jones Street march. That was when the NAACP formed a coalition of what is now more than 175 or almost 200 organizations around a people's agenda, a 14-point people's agenda. And that was to build on some of the kind of progress we're talking about here, talking about addressing issues of education and criminal justice and our North Carolina history and an end to so much military spending and more money here at home. So that was when we had a Democrat in the governorship and in control of both houses of the North Carolina General Assembly. So that this is, I think Reverend Barber and other leaders of our movement have pointed out, this is not a partisan effort in that whether it's a Democrat-controlled or Republican-controlled General Assembly, there are important things to be struggling for. So people came out in 2008 and have come out every February since then. Unfortunately, for the last two sessions of the General Assembly, there have been so many restrictions and changes in laws and lost opportunities that the focus has not been so much on advancing a people's agenda, but just fighting to maintain some of the things that we've got. And I'm sure I know you've had a number of speakers on your show talking about some of those, the failure to expand Medicaid, the cutbacks in unemployment insurance, the attacks on women's reproductive rights, the attacks on LGBTQ community.
The education.
Public education and the environment, just so many things. But in North Carolina, we forged a powerful Historic Thousands on Jones Street Forward Together movement. Mm-hmm. Over 1,000 people have been arrested, including many of the people in this room. And among our listeners. So I think at the same time that we're looking at a very negative situation in terms of voting, we've also can see that the march and rally in Winston-Salem Monday night are part of this larger struggle of the people of North Carolina for justice. And I think that's very heartening.
It is. And the spirit on Monday, it was so hot, and I'm always moaning and groaning and complaining when it's hot. And I think there was a bank across the street, and it may have been a slight exaggeration, but only slight. It's at 104 degrees, and this rally took place in this huge open a plaza in the boiling sun. You know, on each side, the periphery, there were some trees, but in the middle. And I just was so amazed at the people filled up that plaza with so much spirit. It was just heartening. It made you realize you're not alone. You get upset. You stamp your feet in your living room. You know, you cuss, whatever. But then to get with so many people who have similar feelings, and not just have them, but are out there to show with their bodies that they are, that they're there, that they're going to protest. It's not going to get, it's not going to get forgotten. It's not going to get lost. It's the people are trying to get their voice heard, and they're going to keep protesting until they get their voice heard. And it was very, very good spirit. It was really, really very heartening. And I think that spirit will kind of carry us along, and I hope that we have something to celebrate at the end of this trial. We'll have to wait and see, yeah.
Well, we have a three-part strategy for the Okay. Forward Together movement, basically not only with the trial but with the other issues we've been talking about this afternoon. You know, clearly one is legal, taking on these issues in the courts. Another is education. And then, of course, we have mass mobilization. So we have advocacy and mobilization and legal strategies that are part of the fight
yeah.
for justice.
Yeah.
And certainly Monday night, Monday afternoon, Monday evening in the hot sun.
In that hot sun.
But listening to a broad range of ministers and speakers, including the brother of Goodman, who was murdered in Mississippi, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, and having a letter from his brother specifically for that day, thanking people for coming out and talking about what a change had made in his life. Young people singing, Reverend Barber talking about the power in the blood, that there's power in the blood of the folks that were killed in the voting rights struggle, and Viola Liuzzi, and Reverend Reed from the Unitarian Church, and Jimmy Lee Jackson, and then the nine in Charleston, and
yeah.
the power of that history and our dedication to go forward. And then the crowd ended up by singing Glory, which is the song from the movie Selma. And I think there were signs there, you know, Winston Selma, bringing in that connection. So I think that the spirit of the crowd was, yes, that no matter what happens in this court case, that we'll continue to stand for justice.
Yes.
That we're part of a movement, obviously not just here in North Carolina with the trial, but that the Forward Together More Monday movement now has been, that message has been carried out across the nation, and there are at least 22 states that have some
22?
Version of a Forward Together movement. Actions in their state legislatures, groups that are getting together, and so Reverend Barber and his colleagues and the NAACP have been sharing the lessons of Moral Monday around the country.
I had no idea it was 22. I knew that there was some other states, and some were having it on Tuesday instead of Moral Monday, and that the another state it was on Friday, but it is 22. That is so impressive. Reverend Barber is absolutely an amazing prophet for our times, and he is so powerful with such a moral voice, and he always makes the point, you know, this is not Republican or Democrat, you know, black or white, we all need to be together, you know. He just makes everyone feel so welcome and is so inclusive. It's not an easy thing to be able to do, to make it come across so authentically and with so much passion and heart and soul. You know, he's the bright spot in this state. He really is he's our shining beacon of hope. He really is. And we just keep thinking, as long as Reverend Barber's out there, we got to be out there too.
That's right. The need's very clear that this is a movement, not a moment.
Not a moment. Absolutely. Well, Lucy, the other thing I didn't want to have you leave before, we've been mentioning, at least in some of our other shows, that we're talking about that 2015 It's been an important date in some other aspects. It's also really important to the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
That's right. On the bus back, I was talking to my seatmate, and he said, "How do you decide which issues to get involved in?" And I said, "Well, I'm a member of the Orange County or the Chapel Hill Carbon NAACP and the Triangle Branch of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom." And that's how I decide that both of those are multi-issue organizations.
Multi-issue.
And that through the NAACP, I can be supporting local struggles, particularly around the issues of education, local policing, a number of other issues. And, of course, most of our WILPF members are also members of the Chapel Hill Carbon NAACP or NAACP in the branches where they are, whether it's in Durham or Wake County or Chatham County. But then I said for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, we're not only dealing with state and national issues, we're dealing with international issues. So by going there, I can be supporting the fight against military spending, U.S. intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, supporting the fight for clean air and clean water. Some of our WILPF members have been part of the leading the fight in North Carolina against fracking and offshore drilling, and now against coal ash and the contamination of the water that we drink. We have other folks that have been working on labor issues. Miriam Thompson, who's the chair of our labor committee,
also and Iris works with her on labor issues.
We're instrumental in getting some of the changes made in the Chapel Hill personnel ordinance recently. So by being part of these two organizations, I'm able to lend my support to many, many different issues. I said, I don't have to go to 10 different meetings. You know, I can go to two that are really important and speak out on, you know, be supporting and advocating on all the issues that I think are really important of the day. And, of course, here in Chapel Hill Carborough, WILPF has been here since 1935, making us 80 years old this year, and WILPF nationally and internationally has been around for 100 years this year. That's a really remarkable legacy, to be able to hold together an organization for that many years. And the thing that I love about WILPF is that when it was founded in 1915, it was founded by a group of women from around the world who came together to say, not only do we want to see an end to World War I, but we want to address the root causes of violence. And that includes economic issues. It includes racism. It includes sexism, that there are so many root causes that create violence around the world. So that WILPF has been active in those in Chapel Hill Carborough for years, that our members were instituted the longest-running vigil against the Vietnam War from 1968 through 1973. We're the backbone, I think, for the current vigil that's held on Elliott Road on Friday evenings, supporting the Catholic workers who started the movement, but providing the foot power for week after week. That was started against the sanctions in Iran or Iraq, but obviously have gone on to address the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and other kinds of war. We've been active in not only the issue of the personnel ordinance I talked about, but for a year our members were on the picket line with plywood workers down in Moncure, North Carolina.
Every week, faithfully, and brought a bunch more people along to support them.
Attention to the issue, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to increase community awareness, bring it to the local county
in Chatham,
commissioners,
yes.
In Chatham County,
the
and
commissioners.
The NAACP, mm-hmm. Call on their own union, their national union, to take a stronger stand. So I'm just really proud to be part of WILPF and glad to be celebrating this year. We're one of the HKNJ partners. We're very active in the local work here. And both of these organizations have always fought and struggled for justice. And like I told my seatmate, you know, it just makes it pretty simple what to do.
Well, and this is our 100th birthday. And it's just amazing to me when that it was started here in the South in 1935. It's just absolutely amazing that a radical organization like WILF was able to flourish here. And so I'm very proud to be a member. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me when I retired. I'd been reading about the weekly, or was it weekly or monthly, vigils, and I thought, when I retire, that's what I'm going to do. And I did, and it's the best thing I ever decision I ever made in my life. I'm just so glad to be part of it. And so we're going to have a party in November. Stay tuned. You can come, too.
I was just wondering, if people wanted more information, we have a local WILF website. Is that, you could correct me on this if I'm, it's the local website is triangle and then WILPF.org. Is that correct?
That's
people
right.
can find. Okay. Good.
Is that the best way to contact WILF?
I think so. Because that also includes how you can become a member,
yes.
What the listserv is, and a calendar of events. We're currently working on making that be updated more regularly.
Okay.
But that lets people know how they can be in touch, as well as has information about past events, speakers we've had, forums we've held, struggles we've been part of. It also lets people know about our radio station,
yes.
and our work here with WCOM, alerting the community to the social justice issues of the day.
And that's what we try to do, is let people know what's happening, what local people are trying to do about it. And so glad that you were able to come today. I have to mention that Lucy is a three-generation WILF member, your mother, you, and then your daughter.
And we also were able to bring my son Michael to a number of the Moral Mondays.
Oh, my God.
He's 6 years old.
Well, he may.
And so we talked to him about why we were doing it and what the issues were about. He calls it doing peace.
Oh.
And there was one of the first sessions where they had changed the laws in the General Assembly about where you could assemble and so forth. So for that particular Monday, all of us wore tape over our mouths as we walked through the General Assembly. And my daughter and I explained to my grandson why we were doing this, that they were trying to keep people from speaking. And he said, I want a piece of tape, too.
Oh.
So he walked with us through there.
6 years old.
And he's one of the reasons why I keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I think that what kind of future we leave for our children and for
yes.
our grandchildren is terribly important, that what we do affects not only our world, but the future. And I think that the long legacy of both the NAACP and WILF are testament to that.
I feel the same way. You know, at my age, a lot of these things, if they get worse, I'm not going to be here that much longer. But when I think of my kids and my grandkids, it's just like when I first heard about Native American spirituality, about you have to, every decision you make, you should be thinking about the seven generations, how it's going to affect the seven generations. And that is such a powerful way of looking at things. And to keep that in mind makes such a difference. And if we could just inculcate that philosophical depth into our legislators and our politicians. You know, the decisions that they make would be so different.
Well, you mentioned that my mom was a member of WILF.
Yes,
I think
she
we
was.
Have several WILF members that are second or even third generation
yes.
members. And I think it's such a gift from our mothers.
Well, Ann Schwab, her mother and her grandmother, wasn't it? Ann Schwab is going to be getting out. Listen, folks, the WILF newsletter, long awaited and long for, will be coming out soon. So be prepared. Nan Schwab has agreed to be our editor, and her mother and her grandmother were members. So, yeah, there's several three-generation folks. How are we on time? We got time yet. We got time yet. So I don't know. I hope I said, but feel free to chime in. Anybody who's sitting here, the mics are open. So what have we left out, Lucy?
Well, I was just going to come back to your discussion about what WILF meant in your life,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about my own mother's life.
Who was Lucy's part of mother
the,
was
the vigilers, and basically how it opened up the world to her too.
Yeah,
that she had been raising six kids and had We had, you know, boycotted segregated facilities here in Chapel Hill Carver when I was growing up. But then with the Vietnam War, she really became an activist and then became Southern Regional Vice President of WILPF and got involved in a number of political issues, political prisoner issues, starting with Joanne Little. Then she co-chaired.
You might say what that is about Joanne Little.
Joanne Little was a black woman who was attempting to be raped in prison by her jailer, and she killed him with an ice pick in self-defense and then escaped. And it became a very important political case. Then my mother and WILPF became big supporters of the fight to free the Wilmington 10.
Yes.
Here in North Carolina. So that this organization, which has a NGO status at the United Nations, has an office in Geneva, which has been speaking out on issues. And it's obviously, just like the NAACP, is open to black and white and
men and women, in spite of our
WILPF is the same thing, too. That it's organized and led by women.
Yeah.
But we are open to anyone to be a member and to join us in the struggle for justice throughout the generations and for future generations. So I hope that our readers will continue to pay attention to this trial, pay attention to the agenda of the HKNJ movement, and think about joining both our local Chapel Hill Carver NAACP and our Triangle branch of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Those are two very important steps that people can take.
Yes, we'd like to. Yes, we should say we would love to have you join us in this in the struggle. Join us. There's great bunch of people, and you just learned so much. I mean, I have learned so much since I joined WILPF. And you think, you know, and it's not just you learn, it's an ongoing thing because things keep changing. Mm-hmm. And without that support of organizational support, it's just so easy to get off track with the current media. You can easily just think, oh, well, yeah, you know, it's just so easy to keep your thinking through the complexity of things and not get sidetracked.
There's an important sense of solidarity and spirit. One of the things I forgot to mention was also that WILPF was the group that kept the Raging Grannies going for so long in the Triangle, and now
we did.
It's got an even bigger core of people, but most of those are members of WILPF as well. And the importance of singing and sharing both our politics but also our spirit are important things that both of these organizations do.
Yes, yes. Yes, you can't go to a WILPF retreat, triennial retreat, and there's always a huge Raging Granny contingent there. Okay, we got two more minutes. Next week, we're hoping to have Reverend Campbell, the head of the local NAACP branch. And the week after that, we're hoping to have Wanda Hunter, who's led workshops on diversity. She and her husband, Ty, were both arrested in the Moral Monday protests. And she's also a staunch, articulate, important member of the NAACP's Education Committee, of which I'm very happy to be part of. And I feel I'm just there sort of learning because there's so many people have been so involved with education. It's really a terrific group, and they have a lot planning for this summer. Okay, listen to us. I'm Lori Hoyt. Emily O'Hare was on the board. Iris Schwentzer. If I got that right,
close enough,
is here, and she's also on the board and learning to be part of our crew, we're with WCOM, and that's another volunteer run, and we're so thrilled to be part of WCOM. Mm-hmm.
Join us again next Wednesday at 5:00. Thank you.
Thank you.
Listen to Radio In Vivo with Ernie Hood, Wednesdays at 11 a.m., here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, Carborough, your community radio station.